The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Welcome back to the FlightBridge Ed Podcast. I know, not the voice that you were expecting to hear, but lovely nonetheless, I hope. So we're going to switch things up with this episode. You're going to be hearing me, Ashley Bauer, throughout this episode. Got rid of Eric altogether, and it's just you and me. So, let's do this thing. So I'm sure that all you've been reading about, listening to lately has probably been concerning the current COVID-19 pandemic. And I know that at times it probably gets very laborious. You just want to move on to something else, but it's not really that easy. Our society has been changed drastically in the blink of an eye. And as healthcare providers, we've all been dealt something that we've never experienced before. We've had to learn how to treat these patients in a very short amount of time. We've not had a lot of previous experience and education to go on, so things are changing rapidly. The way we did things yesterday is no longer how we're doing things today. So we're going to look at a patient scenario today, and we're going to try to walk through the basics of what to expect and what is truly being seen in these patients. There may be some of you who live in more rural areas, and you may not have had to deal with your first true COVID patient yet, but I guarantee that time is coming for you. And there are probably others of you living right in the middle of these hot spots. You can probably add a lot more information to my knowledge base because of everything that you have been experiencing firsthand. But let's look at this patient. So we have a 42-year-old. They came in complaining of intermittent fever and cough for 1 week. They say that the cough has been intermittently productive, but really and truly, they're just not feeling well overall. They also complain of some constipation that's been occurring over the past 4 days, some intermittent nausea. They typically don't deal with constipation, so this is kind of a new finding for them. You know, denies any abdominal pain whatsoever. Highest reported temp at home has been 101.6 per the patient. They did see their primary care provider earlier in the week. Their PCP had ordered an abdominal x-ray, which was negative. They placed them on Leviquin at that time for bilateral pneumonia. So they were taking Leviquin 500 milligrams every day that was given to them by their PCP, but they've had no improvement in their symptoms after 5 doses of the medication. So they present today with these complaints. They deny any recent travel, no known COVID-19 contacts, deny any difficulty breathing, chest pain, anything else associated. Past medical history includes high blood pressure and obesity with current weight at 165 kilos. Home medications include Atenolol, 100 milligrams every day, and Losartan/HCTZ, 100/12.5 daily. They have not taken their meds today. So upon arrival, temp is 99.7, so mildly febrile, nothing real significant. Blood pressure at 100 over 60, which does get you to thinking, especially that they admit, you know, with a known history of hypertension and they have not taken their blood pressure meds today, you know, that's kind of a lower BP probably for this patient. Heart rate 94, O2 saturation room air 94%, and respiratory rate at 18 and unlabored. So you go to physically examine the patient and you notice that you have an obese Caucasian patient lying on the stretcher, head of bed elevated, no obvious distress is noted. Breath sounds tend to be decreased bilaterally, but overall really no adventitious breath sounds upon auscultation. You do note that the patient appears to be a little bit tachypneic with you making conversation with them, but really overall, there's no obvious significant distress that's noted in them. Their abdomen is soft, round, of course, non-tender, bowel sounds are present. Really and truly, all other physical exam findings are within normal limits. There's nothing truly alarming that kind of presents itself at this point. So let's kind of go off to the side here and let's talk about a typical presentation. And I say typical very loosely because not everybody is typical when it comes to this virus. But for this podcast, let's just say typical presentation. I think for me, you know, prior to truly seeing COVID patients, like true COVID patients, I had read all this information, as I'm sure everybody else did, on what I should expect and what I'm going to see. But that's not the way that these patients are presenting, or truly haven't been with me. Patients are not presenting as this traditional patient, as all this information stated that they would. Most information does still say that, you know, cough and fever are probably the two most common presenting symptoms in patients. And while I say that that's probably true, I think it's important to remember, though, that not all patients are going to fit within this exact clinical picture. There are studies now that are estimating about 25% of patients are asymptomatic, which is kind of scary. I think that's why there's such a push for, you know, all this stay at home, especially if you have one in four people that's walking around out there truly carrying COVID-19 and spreading it to everybody that they come in contact with because they just don't know that they have the virus. So clinically, between about 2 to 10 days after exposure, average median has been about 5 days after you get exposed to COVID-19, most patients present with flu-like symptoms, or that's when these symptoms begin. Typically, these include, you know, fever, chills, headache, cough, of course, maybe some myalgias, nausea, not a lot of vomiting, but more nausea, some abdominal discomfort, some people say diarrhea. Less common is that loss of smell that we're seeing, anorexia, but they may just present just overall fatigue, not feeling well, kind of as our patient did as well. So with that being said, patient presentation really has been varied overall. Patients may be presenting hypoxic, even O2 sats in the, you know, low 80s, upper 70s, without true dyspnea, difficulty breathing, any of those previous clinical signs that we would expect to see. You will see these patients presenting in renal failure from dehydration, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get more into the lab section of this podcast. But the clinical course overall trends toward two different stages. So that first stage begins around 5 days after your initial onset of symptoms. And that's where these patients start to have this increasing shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, with findings of this bilateral viral pneumonia on their chest x-ray. This is typically the start of that direct viral damage that we're seeing to the lung parenchyma at that time. The second stage is really where the rapid clinical deterioration can occur. So around day 10 from symptom onset is when these patients begin to experience the cytokine storm, or this profound inflammatory response, which leads to acute ARDS and multi-organ failure. This usually occurs within a matter of hours, and this is where providers are noting that their patients are stable and they can literally watch them deteriorate to the point of death right in front of them. Like, they can see this massive decline just all of a sudden. And that's what I think is really scary about the virus altogether. Now, statistics are saying that around 80% of our patients are presenting with mild symptoms only, and that's really all that they experience. 15% of these patients are the more severe symptoms, which is typically what you're seeing being hospitalized and dealing with within the hospital. And then 5% is more of that really critical stage. There are a lot of patients, you know, we just talked about 25% of patients are truly asymptomatic. So there are a lot of patients that have been found to have COVID-19 after discovering, you know, maybe bilateral interstitial pneumonia on x-rays for some other reason. So maybe this patient came into the ER for a shoulder issue and they had a shoulder x-ray, and on that x-ray, it noted bilateral interstitial pneumonia. prompting this patient to be tested, which turned out to be COVID-19, and this patient had no symptoms whatsoever. You know, they were there for a totally different reason. There's been cases where, you know, patients have come in maybe requiring an abdominal CT, or maybe it's a polytrauma patient who is requiring multiple CTs, and on those CTs, they're found to have this same characteristic bilateral interstitial involvement that we're seeing associated with COVID-19. And so again, they're truly asymptomatic, but they end up leaving with a diagnosis of COVID-19 as well because of these random diagnostic findings. We are seeing that, you know, initial reports from China do estimate approximately 15% of their patients had cardiac involvement. There are several COVID patients that are presenting with cardiac involvement upon initial presentation. Most often, this is demonstrated with an elevated troponin. There's still a lot of limited data for exact mechanism, but there are some thoughts that maybe this is due to, could be direct toxicity through that viral invasion into the myocytes within the heart. So you're looking at kind of like a myocarditis type situation. This may be true ACS as well as just a demand ischemia problem that's elevating the troponin in these patients. Could also be associated with just a simple stress cardiomyopathy. And I say simple as in not truly simple in nature, but there may be nothing else associated with that that would cause that. There are cases where there's thoughts that maybe this is, you know, myocardial suppression due to that profound inflammatory response, cytokine storm that these patients experience. And I know we're getting a little bit kind of off subject here on patient presentation, but, you know, I do think it's important to discuss these things because you may have patients presenting with true cardiac involvement that may end up being COVID, or they may be known COVID and are now experiencing cardiac involvement secondary to that. It really depends on the hospital, the facility that you're transporting to, but cath labs can and do still accept COVID-19 patients even on the ventilator. That's not to say all will and all do. There's a lot of resource constraints. There's a lot of other factors that go into that, whether these cardiologists are truly taking these patients straight to the cath lab or not. That's going to depend on a lot of other findings, trending of levels, things like that, that go along with those decisions, things that we're not going to dive into in this podcast. But just know that there are a lot of facilities, because of resource constraints, maybe inadequacy of door-to-balloon time, that some true STEMIs are getting lytic medications in the ED, and they may be deferring, you know, PCI to maybe true rescue PCI at 60 minutes only if those lytic medications fail. So it's not completely surprising if you come across this. Again, there's a lot of other factors that go into that. I'm not saying that's true for every single facility. But just know that if you do encounter that, that's not always uncommon right now during these times. There's a lot of things that go into those thoughts. And again, that would be deferred to cardiology consult at that time. That would be completely up to them at that point. So let's go back to our patient presentation. So let's look at some of their labs. They had a respiratory PCR panel, which was negative. Their CBC reveals a leukocytosis, so a decreased white blood cell count at 3.0. Usually when we see that decreased white blood cell count, we automatically think of viral process, or maybe their body is completely overwhelmed by a bacterial process. Although, you know, our patient did not present in what we would think was a sepsis condition. Their H&H, a little bit low at 12.8 and 36.6. Again, you know, we don't really have much of a history on this patient. This may be a normal finding for them, but really not anything alarming, nothing that we would chase or go after at this point. Their percentage of neutrophils was elevated at 72.6. Normal for this lab was 43 to 65. Their lymphocytes were decreased at 16.1%. Again, normal for this lab was 20 to 45%. Their absolute neutrophils were within normal limits, but their absolute lymphocytes were decreased at 0.6. And again, just to kind of give you reference, a norm for those would be 1.3 to 2.9. So as far as the CMP goes, so their comprehensive panel, sodium at 129, so that's a little low. Potassium a little low at 3.3. chloride at 87, BUN is elevated at 33, creatinine elevated at 1.5, AST is elevated at 186, ALT elevated at 162, their alk-phos was within normal limits at 51, and total bili was normal at 0.4. Lipase was normal, amylase was normal, procalcitonin was negative, their LDH, which is the lactate dehydrogenase, was elevated at 625. ABG on Roux-Mayer, pH is 7.47, CO2 33.3, PO2 of 61.4 with an O2 set of 90.6. Initial chest x-ray did show interstitial prominence throughout, so that patchy airspace disease that was noted in both lung bases in this patient. So let's stop there and let's kind of look at most common workups of these patients whenever they present for treatment. And again, this is going to depend on the patient's clinical presentation. Because there's such a shortage, because there's such a demand right now, if they have stable vital signs, if they appear clinically well and there's no significant medical history, a lot of these patients can be treated and released with quarantine directions. You know, they're given supportive care instructions, they're given those CDC guidelines on quarantine at home, and strict return precautions. So common labs in these patients may include a respiratory PCR. This is typically done if there's a suspected alternate viral etiology for the symptoms. Respiratory PCR is really a test. It's a nasal swab that's completed that tests anywhere from, you know, 14 to, I'm wanting to say upwards of 18, 19 different common viruses that are encountered. And so it'll give you a printout of either not detected or if the patient was positive for one of these common viruses. I know in our facility, in some of the facilities I work in, there was such a dramatic shortage of COVID testing at one point that if patients came in with milder type symptoms, they might get a respiratory PCR panel. If it was positive for something that we could attribute those symptoms to, then we would diagnose them saying, you know, you've got a viral illness. Here's what we need to do at home. Go ahead and self-quarantine, you know, just to be on the safe side. There was just no way, and even today, there's still no way that we have the capabilities in our area currently to test for every single patient that presents requesting testing. So you did have to kind of pick and choose as far as clinical presentation of those patients, you know, when you used what testing method. But you always have to keep in mind that there are several patients who have tested positive for different viruses. They may test positive for influenza, and they may also come back positive for COVID-19. So just because they test positive for influenza does not mean that that co-infection cannot occur. So again, you know, you have to kind of take your patient presentation and apply it to what you're seeing in front of you and what you have available at your hands in order to decide what testing you need to do. Unfortunately, you know, like I've already hit on, testing kits are still very scarce in a lot of areas. Not all patients can be tested. If they're stable, if they're going to be discharged home, they may not be tested. They may be advised to self-quarantine with those CDC recommendations. We are seeing more and more testing centers arise, but there are still shortages limiting the number of individuals that can be tested. Those turnaround times for tests, I know some of these other facilities are seeing hours of, you know, 4 to 12 hours. We're still seeing some turnarounds of 24 or 48. And even some areas are still experiencing turnaround times of 5 to 7 days, depending on how much availability they have to testing centers, to different labs, things like that. So as far as a patient's CBC goes, their white blood cell count, usually normal to low. That lymphopenia, so that decrease in lymphocytes, is very common. You may see some mild thrombocytopenia, really nothing significant there. As far as their CMP goes, so their comprehensive panel, their liver function tests are commonly elevated. So that's that elevation in AST and ALT that we saw in our patient. You're also seeing a lot of elevations in the BUN creatinine associated with an acute kidney injury. So that renal failure from dehydration that we hit on earlier in the podcast, that's becoming very common in these patients, especially the more ill that these patients are. Typically, their coagulation studies, so their PT, INR, PTT, those are usually normal. D-dimers in these patients are commonly elevated, but you have to be very, very careful with the D-dimer. We're not automatically doing CTAs of the chest with elevated D-dimer and hypoxia as you would typically see in these patients to rule out a PE, right? A lot of these patients who are receiving IV contrast end up in further renal failure, and they're actually seen on the vent sooner. So you really have to be careful. You know, if you still have a really high suspicion, things like that, you know, that's going to be up to the provider. You're probably going to have nephrology consult at that point. But just know that just because they have an elevated D-dimer, they're not automatically going for CTAs of the chest. Procalcitonins, usually not increased with COVID-19. If they are elevated, that's usually seen at a later clinical course or a clinically progressing patient, or it may indicate that you have an alternate diagnosis present, maybe a superimposed infection within that patient. CRP, which is a C-reactive protein, it's an inflammatory marker, also elevated in these patients, and that tends to trend upward with progression of the disease as well. The LDH, which is that lactate dehydrogenase that we talked about earlier, commonly elevated in these patients. And then the true COVID PCR, which is the test that's truly for COVID. Again, you know, we're not going to harp on this, but those are not always immediate results in a lot of areas. There are some false negative findings in up to, you know, 10% of cases right now. I've seen several cases where there's been false negative, so it does make me question even that low 10%. But that's what statistics are saying as of right now. As far as diagnostic imaging goes in these patients, chest x-rays are going to show that patchy ground glass opacities. Typically, these are bilateral, predominantly peripherally. Hypoxia does not always correlate with these chest x-ray findings. The weird thing is that these patients' lungs typically do not sound bad. You know, when you see the chest x-ray findings, maybe they present with hypoxia, you would expect to hear a lot of adventitious breath sounds in these patients, and they're just not presenting that way. A lot of patients are pretty clear to auscultation, which is surprising, you know, after you see their chest x-rays. If it's pretty early in the disease course, a lot of these patients can present with chest x-rays that are clear, and those patients may quickly progress over days to that patchy ground glass opacity appearance that we're seeing bilaterally. Early on, whenever we started screening these patients and doing these testing, we did a lot of CTs on these patients because the CT was able to detect those subtle opacities that maybe were not picked up within a chest x-ray. But we no longer do those routine CT scans in these patients unless, again, you know, unless you have a concern over an alternate diagnosis that would warrant doing that. There's no change in management at the end of the day, and it just exposes more individuals when it's really not necessary. So basically, you have a patient presenting in front of you with bilateral pneumonia. They have a normal to low WBC. They have lymphopenia. They have a normal procalcitonin. Elevations in the CRP. Ferritin, which we didn't really discuss, but that's typically elevated in these patients. You know, elevations in LDH. That patient has COVID-19. And you really do not need a swab to tell you such. That's a pretty classic presentation for these patients. Elevations in AST, ALT as well. You test these patients, they're going to come back positive for COVID-19. So really and truly, you know, we don't need to do a whole lot of other testing to confirm something that we can already see in our patient. So let's talk a little bit about treatment. Treatment is very vast in these patients. There's a lot of different things that come together depending on how your patient is presenting, how they deteriorate clinically, but treatment is mainly supportive in nature. The one key thing to remember, these patients tend to be very sensitive to fluid overload. So fluids should be used very judiciously as it hastens their respiratory decompensation overall. Most providers that you see are keeping patients in the net negative, even with tachycardia and acute kidney injury or renal failure that you're seeing. Net negative being you want them urinating or putting out more than they're taking in. That keeps them at a net negative. And this has really been shown to help prevent intubation in these patients. If your patient is hypotensive, you know, maybe consider starting low-dose pressors. Levofed has been shown to be kind of the first choice there in that pressor. just to support their MAP rather than trying to give them multiple fluid boluses, which again, you know, only further complicates their situation, possibly deteriorating them more rapidly and increasing their overall morbidity mortality. Do not give fluids to attempt to clear an elevated lactate. That was seen initially in a lot of these patients, and really that's what you've been taught right from the very beginning, especially when it comes to sepsis and the presentation of sepsis and the push for fluid administration, especially with the elevated lactate, but not in these patients. We are not giving them fluids in an attempt to decrease that elevated lactate. As far as ventilated patients, proning of those ventilated patients has really shown a lot of benefits with oxygenation. Even self-proning of patients who may be on a nasal cannula has been shown to help them with their oxygenation efforts overall. Vent settings typically similar to ARDS, you know, lower volume, permissive hypercapnia, maybe some higher levels of PEEP. That's going to depend on what your protocol is, what you have to follow. There were initial studies out there showing really high levels of PEEP, upwards in the 20, 25. But then the newer studies are showing, you know, they may need higher levels of PEEP, 10, 12, 15. But we're not going drastic with these patients. So again, you know, that you do have to follow whatever protocol you have. I'm sure with further research, further studies, that's probably going to change even further. But do know that you're probably going to be required to increase that PEEP just a little bit on these patients. Do not use nebulizer treatments. If it's necessary, use an MDI, so a metered dose inhaler in these patients. And that's really only needed if you have wheezing in these patients, which typically does not occur very often when you see true COVID patients. If nebulizer treatments are necessary, that patient has to be in a negative pressure room, and I cannot stress that enough. The aerosolization that occurs with giving neb treatments is significant, and so those patients need to be in a negative pressure room. And if possible, really, if that patient has the ability to start and stop the treatment after everybody has left the room, that's the most beneficial thing that can happen, if that's possible. The use of steroids, really still mixed at this time. There's situations where they're being used in really severe cases, but they are not being used for the typical COVID case. There's just no research, no reports to back the use of steroids at this time. Again, you know, treatment is changing constantly. It can also be very complex, multiple specialties involved. This is, again, going to depend on your patient's presentation, on the amount of deterioration, the systems that's involved with that. But really and truly, you know, a few key takeaways is do not give fluids to these patients. Vent settings on these patients, you know, those are going to be your biggest things as far as initially in these individuals. So let's kind of wrap this up. Again, this is just kind of a brief overview of a few things, you know, the presentation, what we're going to see clinically, and just really truly skimming the surface when it comes to treatment. There is a lot more in-depth areas that we can go into with these podcasts, but we're going to keep it kind of simple for this one. So let's go back to our patient above. They did end up decompensating pretty significantly with the hypotension, worsening hypoxia despite increasing their oxygen delivery. They ended up having to be intubated. They did respond well as far as the MAP goes with levofed to titration, so it was able to keep their MAP up. They did receive the hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil. They were successfully extubated after about 11 days on the vent. After continued support and improvement, they were finally discharged home. So this is one of the good outcomes as far as patients go that we have seen. Typically, from my standpoint, I think patients that present with bilateral multifocal pneumonia, a lot of those patients previously were getting admitted. But now a large majority of these individuals are being discharged home. If the patient's not in distress, their oxygen sats are greater than 92%, these patients are being sent home with close community follow-up. You know, I think there's probably a fear in a lot of individuals that these patients will end up deteriorating, possibly not making it back. But it comes down to every single patient cannot be admitted even for observation. Most facilities do not have those resources available. And most of these patients, honestly, as statistics show, about 80% end up with mild symptoms. They recuperate just fine at home after self-quarantining and following up closely. But there are a few that do end up coming back and requiring hospitalization because of that deterioration. I think the one thing to remember is that these individuals will decompensate very quickly on you. So always stay vigilant, monitor closely for any patient or for any changes in your patient's condition. So again, as noted, these guidelines, best practices, they're being updated continuously as further reports are coming in. There's more and more research that's being completed. But who knows? You may listen to this in the next few months, and all this information may now be obsolete. But for the time being, hopefully this will help you provide your patients with the best care that's currently known. As always, if you have any questions, comments, need clarification, anything like that, please feel free to reach out to us. We are here anytime. Hopefully, I haven't messed this up too much and I can maybe partially feel Eric's shoes when it comes to this podcast. More than anything, stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.